thank you, ladies and gentlemen. I'd like to thank you again for being here today. And I'd like to turn the floor over to our second panel. It's a panel on driving technological reform. To introduce our panelists, I'm going to turn to our moderator, Norma Krayem. But before I do that, I'd like to tell you a little bit about Norma. She is currently a partner and senior policy advisor at Patton Boggs LLP, where she is the co-chair of the firm's Homeland Security, Defense, and Technology Transfer Practice Group. She has extensive experience with key national security issues in the policymaking arena based on 20 years of working with state, local, and federal governments. During her distinguished career in Washington, Ms. Krayem has held several executive-level positions in the U.S. Departments of Transportation, State, and Commerce, as well as in the Federal Emergency Management Agency. She's provided key insight and guidance to major officials at the White House, in Congress, and at state and local levels around the country. Ms. Krayem is also helpful in the key area of legislation to actually get these things done, and she helped to create the new departments, including the U.S. Department of Homeland Security. She can share credit and or blame on that front, but more on that later. Ms. Krayem has worked extensively with DHS on a host of security matters which are relevant to today's discussion. They include port cargo supply chain security, border security, U.S. visit, and other biometric-related programs. So please join me in welcoming Ms. Krayem and the panel.
So I like to say I survived government and managed to make my way into the private sector, and so it really is a pleasure to be here today. Thank you to Stephanie and CSIS and our fabulous panel. It really is important to participate in the debate that we're having today. It is something that's clearly front and center, but what we want to do is really focus on innovative ways to integrate technological reforms into this broader discussion. At the end of the day, the use of technology can be very helpful to us, maybe can help break out some of the very partisan and oftentimes challenging debates, and look for useful tools to move, I think, a very hard and challenging issue forward. As we do this, one of the issues is really what do the American people think about immigration reform? Do they support it? Do they not support it? A Gallup poll came out just yesterday, and we're seeing that 85% of the people actually support employers really verifying all new hires. Now, we do have programs that speak to that, but there's more that we can talk about there. 71% said we should create a system that can actually track the departure of foreigners who enter the U.S. through ports of entry. And I know we're going to hear a little bit about that as well. And 68% said we should really be increasing additional security at the borders. But at the end of the day, I think the question for us as the Congress moves forward, after watching a five-hour House Judiciary Committee hearing on Monday, you've got senators who don't always work together, Klobuchar, Hatch, Rubio, McCain, Durbin, who are actually putting out bills that have some very interesting components of reform. But the question for our panel is, wouldn't the use of technology inherently make some of these processes easier? What if individuals could work directly with CIS and authenticate their identity through things like a digital credential? We've seen TSA and CBP grapple with some of these issues when it came to aviation security and passenger name recognition. Maybe CIS could create a similar program to that. We also know that privacy protections have to be integrated into that, and our panel will discuss that as well. Even in the recent bill from Schumer, McCain, and Rubio, they said, quote, "We need to include effective employment verification that will also prevent identity theft and end hiring of future unauthorized workers." Second, maybe more importantly, is how do we redefine the debate for success? I think that's a hard question, and hopefully our panel can address a little bit of that. But at the end of the day, success always seems to be focused on operational control of the border. What does that really mean? And I think that's a challenging issue for us to move beyond. Really, at the end of the day, how do we avoid a push for just a bigger fence at the border? We've tried that. It worked. It didn't work. But at the end of the day, I think there are going to be some very interesting discussions that come from this panel and hopefully questions from the audience. So now that maybe I've scared our panel, on some of the issues they're going to talk about. We're going to start with Bob Mockney, who's the director of the U.S. Visit Program of the Department of Homeland Security. Many of you probably know Bob and have worked with him. He's done a great job at the department. U.S. Visit provides a range of identity management services to federal, state, local law enforcement, and intelligence agencies. And prior to that, Bob served at what some of us may remember in senior positions at the INS. From there, we'll go to Ryan Fox, who's a principal at Equifax, a global leader in information solutions. We do like to say more than just the credit services, so Ryan will regale us with that. Prior to his time there, he worked at Booz Allen's Information Assurance Federal Practice, as well as Identity Management Program at the United Nations. And last but not least on cleanup, we have Stuart Verdery, founder and partner of the Monument Policy Group. But Stuart is known to many of us as being the first Assistant Secretary for Policy at DHS and had to work on a number of very critical and challenging issues, including, of course, immigration, cargo security, and transportation security. So we'll start with Bob.
Thank you very much for that introduction, and thank you all for coming here this afternoon to spend some time with us today. Obviously, this issue of immigration reform and some of the technological solutions that may come from it or add to it are of great interest to you. Otherwise, you wouldn't be here. So I do appreciate your time to kind of listen to us and hopefully engage in some back and forth as well. Lots of friends out there who I know very well who actually worked on the U.S. Visit Program, so thank you to you. A lot of people in industry out there who have contribute today to the program, so I thank you for all the efforts that you have provided to U.S. Visit. We are not successful but for a lot of the people in this room. And a lot of people watching today as well. I will claim as the sole current government employee on this panel for the remainder of the afternoon that I won't be going into the specifics, obviously, of what are still the contours of what we see as immigration reform. We still have to hear from Congress, and the administration is still putting forth its pieces. But what I would like to talk about is what drove us at U.S. Visit in a similar situation that we found ourselves back after the 9/11 events. And where we found ourselves in 2003, where I got a phone call from a senior leader within the Ridge administration who basically said to us at INS, what have you got? What are you doing? Secretary Ridge wants to take this program and make it a hallmark. He wants to make entry-exit something that he's proud of and that the American people will be proud of. So we want to put together the best form possible. And so I credit the department for having the vision to give a firm set of guidelines to an organization and then the political backing and then certainly the financial backing that we got from Congress. Those were all huge elements in what made U.S. Visit successful. The kind of mantra that we followed, and many of you, of course, will know this, is setting clear objectives, what we were trying to do, what was the end goal for U.S. Visit. And then in that, what are the requirements? That's what industry needs to know. Here's our objective, and here are the requirements. Here's what we need to get that thing done. Now, we don't want to be too prescriptive because you want some innovation out there. You want some ideas from industry. We don't have all the answers in government. We never have. And so we want to get requirements laid out there, but broad enough to get the best innovation out there that we could possibly have. And then the third piece of this is to set clear performance measures, measuring if, in fact, those objectives are being met by the requirements that were filled by industry. And then where we are still finding challenges, go back and tweak it and then make it work right to where you then have the successes and then talk about those successes. And so what we found ourselves back in 2003 was having to put biometrics at our ports of entry, 115 ports of entry, work with the State Department to deploy biometrics for visa purposes at over 200 consulates overseas, and that was challenging. But again, a dedicated team of individuals with the right backing, the right funding, gave us the kind of incentive within 8 months to deliver a set of functionality for CBP and for state. State uses our database, didn't have to build their own, another success for the program. But it was our ability to get this thing done in a very clear and precise way. We kind of mounted a campaign to tell the world about what we had to do. I think as we read in the final report of the 9/11 Commission, part of their rationale for giving us some of the direction that we had was to make this, first of all, work within the U.S., make it work within the transportation sector, but then make these standards worldwide so that others would follow. And so in driving this technology, we had to first get it right in the U.S. People were looking at us very skeptically. And they were saying, well, are you going to get this right? You're going to have long lines of ports of entry. You're going to be fingerprinting tourists, not terrorists. You're going to have long lines. You're going to violate people's privacy. And all those things didn't come true. And so soon after we deployed our system in 2004, we had the U.K. saying, how did you do it? We'd like to do the same thing. We had Japan saying, we'd like to do the same thing. And on and on and on, country after country, Australia, the EU went live in 2011. I had a friend with his two sons go on a safari in Tanzania. 10 prints in, 10 prints out. So I don't think we ever, back in 2003, envisioned that the world would have caught on with a lot of the work that we did. Was it a one-off for the U.S.? It could have been. We certainly had to get our work in order. But when others saw the successes of what we did, that then drove a lot of the other features forward. The other challenge that we had, certainly did have, was going from 2-print to 10-print. When we first started the program, we were just doing the left index and the right index, all 115 airports, all the consulates overseas. And then Secretary Chertoff said, we're moving from 2 to 10. Well, guess what? There wasn't a 10-print device to be had out there that would meet our needs. Too big, too slow, too bulky, too intimidating. So we brought industry together, and we said, we need something 6x6x6, lightweight, compact, fast. And, oh, by the way, the current screens on the 2-print system glow red. Could you make it some other color? Because that's off-putting. That means it's hot. Stop. And so in about 6 months, we had 3 different prototypes to choose from. And the one that we chose is now the one of choice around the world, used by the U.K., used by most of the other nations I mentioned before. So again, setting out the clear objectives, putting out the requirements out there, listening to industry, partnering with industry, a little bit of back and forth sometimes. Sometimes you don't get it quite right. But then finally deciding on what that is, and then talk about those changes and talk about the benefits those changes can provide. The last kind of piece of what we worked on was now that we have the kind of biometric system in place, gathering more information on individuals, right, and then partnering with our international friends who were doing the same thing was information sharing. So we started domestically with the FBI. IDENT was created back in 1994 for a specific purpose, primarily for border enforcement and recidivism, who was crossing the border more than once. And a few years later, the FBI created the AIFA system primarily for law enforcement. And they didn't talk to one another. And so we had Resendez Ramirez, some of you may know, the railroad killer, back in 1999. And the Border Patrol, unfortunately, missed him. The second to last time he crossed, they printed him in IDENT, sent him back across the border. He came back and killed a couple more people after that time. And so Congress called for, and of course the EIG called for, some interoperability between the FBI system and our system. Now, in the meantime, that was about 2000. March of 2000 was the OIG report. We had the incidents of 9/11, which kind of delayed us for some time. But finally, and several years later, by September 2006, the two systems now talk to one another. And every day we get thousands of wants and warrants sent to us from the FBI. We get the known and suspected terrorists that the DOD collects overseas. And we get hits from or red notices from Interpol sent to us on a daily basis. This interoperability with the FBI has allowed secure communities to stand up. So now at over 3,000 law enforcement jurisdictions, all 50 states, four territories, and the District of Columbia, local law enforcement, when they arrest someone, can now have that prints verified with our system because of the interoperability we have with the FBI. And then ICE can make a determination whether that person should or should not be deported. And as you heard in the last session here, a record number of deportations last year made possible because of the interoperability. That interoperability has also allowed us now to partner with the 37 countries in the visa waiver program. And now they all are going to provide fingerprints for law enforcement purposes, and we're going to be using the interoperability that we developed with the FBI back in 2006, excuse me, to then further the information sharing among the 37 countries. So this driving of this information exchange, driving of the innovation, as I said, to go back to my beginning, starts with the objectives, starts with requirements, looks at the performance measures to make sure we're meeting those requirements, but then at the end of the day, it's making those known and so that we can spread the benefits of what we've done and let the rest of the world become a lot more efficient at what they do. The last piece I'll close with is a lot of the work we're doing, very proud with setting up the first international biometric sharing system called the Secure Real-Time Platform, and doing that with Australia, Canada, New Zealand, the UK, and ourselves, where starting tomorrow, we begin our real-time sharing with Australia for sharing fingerprint information for visa issuance, refugee processing, people they may find in the country without any documentation, and frankly, even unknown deceased, which has become a big part of our work as well. So we're proud of the work that we've done in the past. If past is somewhat prologue, I'll let you interpret that. But I do think that having this dedicated group of individuals here, having that backing that we've had with the department, and then working and partnering with the tech industry, with industry itself, on a regular basis, has been the key to the success to date. So with that, I'll turn it back to you. Thank you. Ryan?
So just prior to beginning my remarks, as I listened to Bob and what's been done, we're sitting on an innovation panel for immigration and border control, and it struck me as I was listening to Bob talk about the amount of innovation that has occurred already to date, and just thanking DHS and the corresponding agencies for the work they've done to date, and really raising the bar and setting a high bar for the rest of us as we start to talk about this next generation of what needs to be done. So thank you. As Norma mentioned, I'm with Equifax. I'm actually within our fraud practice. It's a global practice. And I'm going to talk about three areas real quickly today before I give this to Stuart. But three areas we really focus on are privacy, the concept of big data and explaining what that means, and fraud. So I want to talk about those three areas today just real quickly within the context of this immigration and border control conversation. So first and foremost is privacy. As we start to go down this road, whether we're talking about biometrics or data, whatever the case may be, I think it's important that we remember that privacy is paramount. The entire concept really exists on a spectrum of protect versus exploit when we talk about identity. And both are very important depending on the use case, and we need to make sure that we're maintaining a balance of that. So within the concept of immigration, the idea is that while we're collecting a lot of information, we're connecting a lot of information between agencies and departments, we need to be empowering the individual to have access to the data, to understand what data has been collected, where is it being stored, and how is it being used. The example I was jokingly using with Norma earlier was I've been here for a month, and I see that there's been 140 job applications via E-Verify with my identity. I've applied for two. This is a bit suspicious. Who has my identity? What has happened? And what are they doing with my information? So that's one. The idea of big data, specifically at the border, but also within the confines of the continental U.S. As well, is the idea that we're constantly collecting massive amounts of structured and unstructured data. Observations at the borders, job applications, benefit applications, et cetera. Constant data observations. These are nodes across the entire country that allow us to see where people are coming in, where they're going, what they're doing next. But if we can't connect that data, namely through a single trusted identity platform, we can't derive any observations from it. If we can't derive any observations from it, the value in and of itself becomes more of a burden and a liability than an asset. So that's one area that I want to touch on. Third is the concept of fraud. A lot of times when we talk about immigration and border control, we talk about, again, as you mentioned, the bigger fence, the louder guns, the brighter lights. But it's the idea that a lot of times people come into this country on good pretense. They come here for good reasons, and they don't want to leave. And so then bad things start to happen. Someone who was originally a good actor starts to morph or emerge into a bad actor. We see things like synthetic identity fraud, true name identity fraud, application fraud, et cetera. So I think it's important as we talk about this particular issue that we think about the totality of circumstances, which is really people come here for a reason. They want to access education. They want to access healthcare. They want a job. They want access to these different assets. And if we have the proper controls in place to ensure that they have followed the proper means of entry and are here under correct terms, we can start to cut the supply and demand situation with access to these benefits that they're staying for. So with that, that's what I have to say.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for having me back. It's great to be affiliated with CSIS. Congratulations to Stephanie and the crew here. I think I saw the award last week of the number one foreign policy think tank in the world again, 3 years in a row. Congratulations. So nice work. It's I didn't expect to have such a big crowd. I think if we just deployed everyone here to go enforce the border, we'd probably be in good shape. It's actually hard to believe. I was on Facebook. Some of the folks that I worked with at Homeland have been started posting things recently that, you know, it's the 10th year anniversary of day one, or the 10th year anniversary of when we moved up to the NAC, which is the worst place in the world to work, but that's okay. And it's hard to believe it's been that long. And I think it's fair that, you know, we recognized from day one, that I was there not quite on day one, but soon thereafter, that technology was going to be a key part of our response and how we could have effective border security while not strangling the economy. And obviously it's been one of the key parts of the department. And I had the pleasure of working with Bob, and I see some folks in the crowd who I won't embarrass by singling them out, but who worked to stand up the U.S. visit program. And again, I think it was one of those things, as they say in the business world, is a stretch goal that Secretary Ridge announced and was able to be met and effective. And I think in some ways it's gotten less credit than it deserves, as because it hasn't been the problematic thing for our entry system. And it's a technology program that really worked. We saw some other successes that I worked on and others worked on, the Western Hemisphere Travel Initiative, which reformed land border travel into the United States, the facial recognition program at the State Department that countered fraud that was a real problem for visa applicants, and then the kind of very unsexy but very important database integration that really has brought kind of all the information that's collected to bear for frontline folks, whether it's TSA, Border Patrol, CBP, ICE, and the like. Those are real successes. I think the dilemma has been our policymaking, really, I think in the last couple years, has really slowed down while the technology business has continued to accelerate. Our firm, we do work for a number of technology leaders, whether it's LinkedIn or Microsoft or Zillow or Travelocity, and I go out and meet with these executives, and they find it hard to believe that problems can't get solved in the government. You mean we can't have a secure credential? We haven't figured out a way to track people when they leave the country? Some of the southern border things about sensors and the like. And I think it's not a lack of technology anymore. It's a lack of policymaking will. And I didn't catch all the first panel, but obviously the looming debate about immigration and border control, I think, is going to represent both a policymaking opportunity to kind of catch back up and also a budgetary possibility. We all know the difficulty we have on the federal side on the budgets because of entitlements. But I do think that if and when there's a deal on immigration, there'll be, in all likelihood, a one-time big chunk of money, you know, kind of like the 12-figure type, as a down payment on the border enforcement and interior enforcement tools that we need to give people confidence that this is kind of, you know, not another failed immigration bill, but something that is going to fix this on an ongoing basis. One measure of the disconnect in technology, I was looking this up, the first iPhone was released, as I understand it, on June 29th, 2007. Do you happen to remember what happened the day before that? June 28th was the day the immigration bill died on the Senate floor in a spectacular filibuster defeat. So that was, you know, close to 6 years ago. Imagine the technology that has been deployed since then, you know, just not just by Apple and in the phone market, but kind of all over the place. Meanwhile, our immigration laws are stuck kind of in, you know, perpetual edition of Groundhog Day, the movie. And it's really a shame. So we have left technology on the cutting room floor that we could have used. At the same time, we have spent more money. In the aggregate, their budgets have gone up, but in large part, they have gone for manpower. So the Border Patrol has gone up substantially. The Customs and Border Protection frontline officers, TSA, detention agents. So kind of all the manpower has gone up, and it's been for good use. It's been effective, I think, in the aggregate. But at the same time, it has strangled the budgets on science and technology, on IT deployment, kind of the less sexy back-end stuff that might have had a bigger bang for the buck. At the same time, we've yet hired, you know, thousands and thousands of people that are more and more expensive. I know Bob can't speak to this, but the U.S. visit budget, I know, has not been accelerating as much as the Border Patrol's. Feel free not to comment. I query where that investment might have been better spent. We've seen programs that could have had some real success over the last couple of years that have been stalled or derailed or just kind of not fully implemented. The Real ID program, you know, kind of the simple goal of making sure that people have secure credentials that you can rely upon, whether you're a business or a landlord or anything else, or a policeman pulling somebody over, has been just turned into a political football between the states and the federal government, and even between DHS and the Congress. So we've left with kind of a half implementation of Real ID. The biometrics on foreign visitors, which you know, should have been done. It has been, again, another football between airlines and DHS, and now between, you know, whether it can be implemented in a cost-effective way at a time when I think anybody would say the technology has caught up. We could do exit either by facial recognition, by iris, by fingerprints, or perhaps best of all by some kind of multimodal deployment without slowing down travelers and at a fairly reasonable price point, something that ought to get done. SBINet, you know, became, again, another political football. It was a kind of a scapegoat for people's concerns about the Arizona and southern border when it actually was showing some good returns on investment. So I'm hoping that, the negotiators on immigration reform will use this opportunity to make technology bring it back into play. You've seen the discussion of triggers, that things would have to be met before a full path to citizenship would be offered to people. And some of them were kind of sexy. I heard the discussion earlier about drones and UAVs, and we're going to have this many, you know, guys with guns, big guys with guns. But maybe we ought to be thinking about the triggers being less sexy stuff. Do we have a functioning exit system? Do databases talk to each other? Do people have secure IDs? Those things might actually be a bigger bang for the buck. I was shocked to see the Washington Post essentially endorse a national ID card. Did anybody see this last week? It's like it's like some kind of alternative bizarro universe. You know, I guess as a means to give certainty to employers and to law enforcement when they encounter individuals. The Gang of Eight framework envisions a, quote, non-forgeable electronic means of verifying identity at the workplace. I'd be interested to see what that means. I'm sure a lot of the vendors in this crowd would like to know. But hopefully once the issue of the undocumented population has been resolved one way or the other, people will begin to get past this and move down a road where we can give people an ID that is tamper-resistant, that's fraud-resistant, and that people can rely upon it to prove people who they say they are. I also mentioned both the Senate framework and the White House plan does require the building of the exit system. It's very doable and hopefully will make it possible to let more legitimate travelers into the country once we feel more confident that they're leaving on time. And lastly, we need to use technology to improve our customer interfaces to make border crossings more user-friendly. Do we really need paper I-94 forms in the era of apps and the Xbox? It doesn't seem like we do. Couldn't we have U.S. citizens confirming their identity at a kiosk as a default, at least? Do they really need to see an officer every single time they come back in to the country? If we can build an entire beltway with RFID technology next door, I mean, couldn't we use that for ports of entry and entry-exit? It seems like we could. Do we really need to sign into buildings with our names every time we go into a regular office building here? Could we have a secure credential that we could show that proves who we say we are? To close, as Congress wanders into this thicket again, and maybe we could take 10% of the new H-1B visa holders that are going to be created in the bill and give them to DHS, to maybe the S&T or to the IT departments in these agencies and, you know, and rebuild some of the scientific work that I think has been starved for money and attention. And hopefully the 20-year anniversary of DHS, you know, we'll see that immigration laws are utilizing technology rather than blocking it. So I encourage y'all to engage with the Hill on this if you're interested in this. I did a quick back-of-the-envelope check. Of the 233 House Republicans, who are kind of the crux of this fight, only 93 of them were in Congress the last time they voted on immigration in 2005 on a major bill. So you got 140 members that have no real history here, except what they may have heard on, you know, Rush Limbaugh or Hannity. So we need to explain to them what technology is out there, what's doable, what's price sensitive, and hopefully we get to the back end of this with a good system that is technology based and we can be proud of. So thanks again to Equifax and the whole CSS team. I look forward to our discussion.
Thank you, Stuart, and thank you to all of our panelists. Why don't we give them a round of applause? All right, now that you've given them that nice round of applause, we'll start with questions from the audience. And if I don't see any, I will be forced to ask each one of our panelists a really hard question. When you do me a favor, when you stand up, just say your name and your affiliation and then your question so they know who you are.
All right. My name is – can you hear me? Okay. My name is Jasmine Aguilera. I'm a reporter at Scripps Howard News Service. My question is for Bob. You spoke a little bit about ports of entry and the technology there. Do you see any improvements going on there or any sort of innovations going on at the ports of entry when the reform comes along?
I don't know if it would be tied to reform. I know that CBP, and I'm not speaking for CBP, but know intimately what they've been doing, especially with global entry, and trying to open more and more ports of entry with global entry. And Jay referred to this in his talk at the opening. That is one of the areas that I see tremendous improvement on, and it's not just our ports of entry. It's the ports of entry across the globe. If you travel anywhere foreign, you're going to see more and more what they call ABCs, automated border controls, or automated border clearance, sometimes they call them. And so this idea that you can use, and again, to bring it back to what we do, a certain identification of the individual, and the biometrics provides that. So taking advantage of biometrics as a near 100% certain way of identifying who that person is, whether it's a pre-registration or not, allows CBP to focus their efforts, and we've been saying this for years now, allows them to focus their efforts on the other individuals. If there's a number out there, 51% or greater, right, all of you traveling into the U.S., and Stuart mentions all U.S. citizens, certainly all eligible for global entry, and so I think they would love to see everyone in this room registered for global entry, and that really is a good part of the answer. And not just the fingerprinting technology. We're also experimenting with iris. We have a pilot down in Texas with Border Patrol and processing people in these are undocumented aliens who are foreign nationals who are coming across the border. And then from an operational standpoint, can we process them in with the iris, capture that iris on their way back out? And we've been very successful in doing so. So iris has a lot of promise, as does facial recognition. Anything that's a little bit less obtrusive than having to put a fingerprint down every single time. We always want the fingerprint for registration purposes to make sure the person is, in fact, low risk. But from a transactional standpoint, we believe that iris and facial recognition are going to be ones that we want to explore. So we're looking at that. We're partnering with CBP to see where we can expand global entry, expand the use of other modalities of biometrics in some of the other lanes. So I think you'll be seeing more to come. And whether that's tied to reform or not, we need it now, and we should be doing it now.
Great. Next question? Yes, right over here, up in front.
Thank you. John B. Lemesia Borbidas. Just a point to you, Bob. I noticed you mentioned a lot about innovations as well as working a lot with Australia. I also noticed that Australia allows you to have a visa without presenting your passport. It's done online. You think the United States will get to that situation?
I don't know. I'm not going to comment for the Department of State on that. They have had their kind of visa-less system for some time now. It works for them, an island, with very few or a lot fewer tourists than we get in the U.S. So I know the State Department issues some 7 million visas on an annual basis, and so it might be a little bit more challenging for us to do something like that. But that doesn't mean that we can't make the process more efficient, and I know the State Department is looking at all sorts of ways to make that a more efficient process for getting visas. We have the visa waiver program where 37 countries, as I mentioned in my opening, can come to the country without a visa. So it's of a similar ilk to what Australia has. We do have ESTA, which is kind of similar to their system as well. Fill out the information online, send it ahead of time. And so we're getting there. We have, again, a bit more challenge than does Australia. But from an information sharing standpoint, we're going to continue to partner with them and look at ways to make both of our systems more efficient. I'll just close with this. On Australia, they recently announced that U.S. citizens can now use their SmartGate system. And so that's going to be a big boon for anyone going to Australia. You can just use their SmartGate system with your e-passport, as any Australian system would as well. So it's moving in the right direction, but we're not quite there where they are yet on that particular issue.
Just one point I wanted to add on that, on the visa system. I think, again, the State Department has done a very good job reducing some wait times in tough countries like Brazil and China, but long haul, we've got to expand access to visas. If we're going to require a visa, we've got to expand access to that. And so we've talked about having video conferencing capability for those next tier of cities in big countries like China, Brazil, Russia, Mexico. So we wouldn't have to have the secure visa facilities. Are very expensive to build now because of security requirements that we need. But people could have an ability to apply and without having to take an extra airplane just to apply. It's a critical thing to do. It should be piloted. The Congress has asked for it to be piloted. It hasn't happened. Secretary Kerry, as a senator, supported it. So we'll see perhaps if that moves forward now with a different State Department at a leadership at the top.
Hi, I'm Abby Magnus from Warpatrack. Hey, Bob, how are you? Bob, sorry to pick on you. You're getting all the questions today. Just very out of curiosity, do you see an expansion of bilateral trusted traveler programs? I know we have them in some five-country initiatives, that kind of thing, and now with New Zealand, Australia added to the mix. Given the new secure platform, do you see that expanding into other parts of Europe?
Well, the secure real-time platform is for a different purpose right now other than Trusted Traveler. That's just for, again, visa applications, asylum, in-country unknowns, and perhaps unknown deceased. So it serves a different purpose at this point. It doesn't mean that it couldn't be used for that in the future, and we've certainly talked about that. I'm going to leave that to CBP for the expansion of the countries. I know that the Secretary has been traveling recently, and we have added new countries to the Trusted Traveler program. The goal is to get more in, not less, and encourage that. So it works well. I know the Secretary is proud of it, and I know CBP is proud of it. So my sense is that it will continue to grow in popularity. And whether or not we have bilats or multilats with the Europeans, remains to be seen. But we certainly have a program with the Dutch. So if you're in the Dutch Privium program and then you apply for the CVP's Trusted Traveler, you can have that two-way program. They're talking to some of the other countries in Europe as well. So I think to answer your question on the kind of at the 60,000-foot level, yes, I see it do expanding. When it gets to the particular countries, we'll probably have to talk to CVP about that.
Bob, is in-country unknown, is that the linebacker's girlfriend or?
May I ask one follow-on question? Do you see an expansion of ABC gates here in the U.S.? You know, we've got them deployed throughout other areas in the world. But do you see real use of ABC gates with on-the-fly biometrics, for example, ever being used here in the U.S.?
Again, I don't want to speak for CBP. I know that CBP has attended meetings in the EU to talk about a common approach and interface to ABCs. I think that's an important element wherever you're going, and that cuts across the board on any issue where you're having a human interface with the machine, and it's the usability factor. And you want to make sure that these people are not intimidated by the factor. They're certainly used to what it means to go in front of a CBP officer. Or an immigration officer throughout the globe, and that's a known process. But when you start introducing machines and fingerprinting and man trap gates, you want to make sure that the individual has a sense of comfort using that, or at least familiarity, and that there's a usability factor. So the commonality of any ABC, I think, is important for the traveling public, because we're such a flat world now. We travel so frequently, many in the business community on a regular basis. It would be best to know that when you go from country A to country B to country C to country D, there's a known process to go through, and I think I would encourage that.
And just real quickly, I think there's two fundamental issues that we need to talk about when we talk about these bilateral programs. One is identity federation. We're still dealing with the concept of what are the technical interface protocols that we are going to accept and move forward with within our own country, let alone how are we going to exchange them across borders with others. And then suitability, which is whole and separate from the interaction of the actual credentials themselves. And so if you go back to PKI days and, how did you get your cert and how did you get your cert and what policy did you follow, the suitability standards across the board have to be agreed upon, and there has to be a trust matrix that's put in place for those to operate. So there's fundamental issues when you look at groups like NSTIC or Transatlantic Secure Collaboration Groups. Those kind of groups are dealing with those, but I think there's still some fundamental issues that need to be resolved there.
Those are good points. Consistency of data, what we're going to ask for. I mean, those are all things from a bilateral, multilateral relationship we really need to focus on. I think there's a question in front. Go ahead. Do we have a mic for him?
Thank you. Ed Olivares from Federal Business Group. What is the entry point for new technology solutions, for example, next-gen facial recognition? Do you have a lash-up with DHS, S&T? Is it through CBP?
S&T does have a very robust program for looking at other modalities, and so that certainly is a good entry point. I know CBP will entertain that as well, but I think if you're looking for some of the kind of the Iris is probably a little bit further along than his facial as far as its ability to be used for recognition. So I would certainly look at S&T as being the kind of entry point for DHS initiatives, at least.
Who within S&T?
Chris Turner is in charge of human factors. So he would certainly point you in the right direction for them.
Thank you.
And just a side point, too, as we're talking about some of these commonalities here, we just published, U.S. Visit just published the NEAM standard for biometrics, and so that's a standard that industry can go to and any international body, any government body can go to look at if you're going to be sharing that information, what those standards are as far as nomenclature and length of fields and everything else. And so that's important from an international data sharing element to the NEAM standards.
Go ahead.
Yes. Hi, Susan Ginsberg. I have a question for actually anyone who wants to answer it, which is, do you see do you see a continuing differentiation between the ID factors, biometric or biographic, being required of U.S. citizens and of non-U.S. citizens in the border process, or do you see that coming together so that there's a common set of requirements?
Sorry, one thing I'll say on the political basis, and again, I mentioned the Post editorials, again, interesting, change of heart for them, I think. This immigration debate is coming at a time when you've also seen kind of the rise of the Tea Party, which has really, I think, grown kind of the right-left privacy coalition. The right part of that had faded off a little bit after 9/11, but I think it's kind of back now a little bit. And I do worry that even though I'd be supportive of kind of more robust databases and good IDs and those kinds of things, that there is a, and you see some of this playing out in the gun debate, is kind of like get the government out of my hair crowd that is particularly popular amongst House Republicans and primary elections. So it does, I think it's going to be a tricky wicket on how they move forward on anything that could be seen as big brother-ish, national ID-ish, taking fingerprints, and there was a robust debate about putting fingerprints into U.S. passports. It didn't happen. Perhaps it should have. Whether that could be mandated now by Congress, I tend to doubt that's a passable thing, even though it would probably be quite a good idea.
If I can just turn that a little bit, because I want to comment the same way that Stuart did.
It's the value of not being a government anymore.
Any one of you, U.S. citizen or not, who would want to go to the U.K. next week, tomorrow, with a long-term visa, you're going to be temperate. If you want to go to other countries within the EU, you're going to be temperate. Canada, Australia, they're going to require that U.S. citizens be temperate for visas, depending on the length of the visa, the type of the visa, so not all visas, perhaps. A visa waiver will still continue. China recently announced they have legislation now to use biometrics for their visa purposes. How they decide to implement that, I don't know. And so I think we need to think about not so much, will the U.S. government fingerprint U.S. citizens for purposes of passports or whatever. That's not my area. But I think we all as a society have to think about what does it mean for us to have our biometrics taken at multiple locations? Because not only are you going to go to the U.K. and Australia and Canada, you might go to some other locations as well. And so it's important for us to all understand what does it mean to be biometrically verified. There was recently an article in the Baltimore Sun about the school using biometrics for kids for lunches. In this one particular school, they stopped it because the parents who weren't properly consulted said, we don't want this to happen. So you have to consider the privacy issues from the very beginning. And if we don't, then we're gonna have issues. But if we do the right things, if we look at privacy, I think some of the things that Ryan talked about, using the big data appropriately, and using the biometrics appropriately and giving proper notification and being concerned about the privacy from the very beginning, then we'll be okay. But I think we're not too far along to make sure that we understand all the parameters of what it means to be biometrically verified and or having our information in multiple databases and being amassed in what we call big data.
Yeah, and so, I mean, when you look at the biometrics, I think that's always a good option for some use cases in some situations. But there will always be situations where that's either not feasible from a privacy perspective, from a cost perspective, perhaps. And so I think, again, it's an area where you need to broaden your aperture, not you specifically, Bob, but we need to broaden our aperture on what trusted identities mean, what are potential credential usage. Social identities is something that nobody's talked about yet, and the idea that everyone has a Facebook account and a Google account and a Twitter account. And I think oftentimes people brush that off as that's completely insecure and anonymous. but it doesn't have to be. I think we should be exploring technologies where we can do step-up authentication and offer trust proxy services where your Facebook ID that you have today that you've already enrolled in to provide zero friction for you to use that to go visit a USCIS site, if you go through the appropriate step-up authentication mechanisms, can be escalated to a level 3 credential for interoperability. So just lots of other opportunities and options there to explore.
One thing I was just going to mention, I think many of us thought that as TSA, this is not about the border so much, but as TSA revived the Trusted Traveler program, Registered Traveler, into what's now PreCheck, that would be the kind of fault line where people would be deciding whether or not how much information they were willing to give over to the government in order to get a smoother, more predictable experience at the airports. But as everyone knows, what they've actually built is kind of a dual program where most people in the program are in it solely because they fly a lot on a particular airline and pay them a lot of money. And a slice of them are in it because they're in global entry. And so you've ended up with this kind of hybrid program where, again, most people are in it without having any type of security review or supplying any type of information other than the fact they have a commercial relationship with a carrier. And I think over time that's probably going to have to change into more of a security review that can get more people in besides just the Uber frequent flyers and the people who do global entry, which, again, is a great program but a very small sliver of the traveling public.
That part of the debate is really going to be educating or helping to form the debate is educating a lot of these members who are on the Hill. To Stuart's point, there are a lot of new people. They don't understand what the process should be. They may eventually get to the point where they understand we need more information about these folks who are coming in and leaving. But then the question is, how much is enough? What should that be? Do you want the government to have that information? Do we trust the government to use it? I think DHS has had a lot of successful programs to demonstrate that. But you do see on the Hill still, whether it's a member has been patted down too many times by TSA, they have issues with how the department runs things, and we need to break through that. There are good ways to do it, but a lot of it is going to have to be a very serious education and very quickly. Go ahead.
Gary Hoffman, just a softer question for you. I lived in the UK at the time when you instituted the first part of it. There was a lot of press over there about people being refused when they came in and mistaken identities and all that. Just has that tamped down over the last few years, and are there fewer instances of it, or what is the experience right now with that?
The amount of kind of outreach that we did for the program, I think, led to a lot of the goodwill that eventually came. I will admit, in the first days of this, first weeks of this, first couple of months of the program, we did have a lot of skeptics about what we were doing was an overreach of 9/11. When they saw, though, of the people that we were catching that we would otherwise miss, number one, and number two, that the whole process was very fast and easy and very non-intrusive, they really began to think twice about it, which is why, as I mentioned, they finally took the decision themselves to be able to implement the same thing. So, again, mindful of the privacy, mindful of the usability factor, people don't mind giving up their information, and it's been pretty amazing out there where they know that extra security is needed. They know of the issues of identity theft and the ease of travel for both terrorists and criminals, and so they don't mind offering up a little bit more information. There will always be some detractors, I'm sure, but the vast majority of people have looked at this, and which is why I said in a very positive way, I think other countries have adopted the technology, and they say it can help them as well. I believe we have an obligation to then share that information as appropriate so that other people aren't getting into the other countries. They now have a way to protect them. So I think if you look at the other countries who've adopted what we're doing, they have taken the decision that this too can assist them in protecting their own country, their own citizens, but at the same time being mindful of the privacy rights and the civil liberties as well.
Go ahead.
Hi, Sarah Lee Boatler, One-to-One Strategies. And just a follow-on comment and question to your words, Bob, about education and knowledge. If I'm going to make a leap and assume that immigration reform happens, we do have deployment of new technology or technologies. As I learned from Bob, with deployment of new technology comes great responsibility. In terms of public education, if we're going to eventually be able to talk about success, and success is compliance. Is there adequate awareness at this point in the immigration reform debate of the need, not only for the technology deployment, but for the education that's going to go with it, that's going to ensure compliance? I know U.S. Visit did that with to great effect. Is there an awareness or even thinking at this point in the process on the Hill or the administration that you're aware of, any of the panelists? Thank you.
I'm not so sure. I mean, I think the debate so far has been kind of the, I call it the part of the legislative process that the iceberg is above the water, and the part below the water is still working out, much less kind of the education. I mean, I didn't hear all the first panel, but I know there's some discussion about if you had a large legalization, let's call it, program, you know, how do those people come forward? What are they providing? How are they vetted? You know, how are they encouraged to come forward? You know, where are they? I mean, are they coming to application centers? It's a lot of people. We've had harder times pulling off smaller programs with smaller numbers of people who want to join. In this case, they may be very nervous about coming forward, especially if the disqualifying criminal criteria are not as clear as you might think. So I think there's a lot of issues to be determined. One issue that's gotten remarkably little discussion on so far is, what is the effective date? What was the date by which you had to be here to qualify? And how do you prove that? Because if it's any, you know, whatever it is, people are going to try to create a paper trail that shows they were here the day before. And if the bill's introduced next month, let's say, and it's next month, you know, you're going to have a lot of people rushing before Schumer hits the press conference. My guess is they're going to backdate it at least some period of time. But that'll be a big thing of document fraud that people have to worry about. This is a big problem with the 86 bill. And while the technology is great on all the reasons we've been talking about here, it's also great for forging fake documents.
I'd say in the Congress, they haven't even gotten to that point yet. They'll try and figure out what they think they need to do and then magically think it will work itself out. Last question. That might be the last question. Well, I want to thank again all of our panelists and all of you for participating in this and for a vigorous discussion. Thank you.
As a former congressional staffer, if someone disillusions me that magic doesn't exist, I'm going to be shocked. We have about a 10-minute break, and so please, if we could reconvene here at 3:50. Thank you.